Hi, welcome to Digging to China. I'm Dong Sheng reporting from Washington, D.C. At the end of 2006, it seemed everything was in place for China's stock market to embrace a golden decade. The country's robust economic growth, the anticipated appreciation of the yuan, a strong rebound in the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchange in 2006, and plenty of money still flooding in. But recent market performance has government officials and some analysts concerned that a bubble is forming that could burst at any moment. Within 10 minutes after the index temporarily surpassed the all-time high of 2,800 points, the Shanghai Stock Composite Index fell by 100 points. The day also experienced the biggest swing between its high and low in nearly 5 years, with volume dwarfing the highest peak volume in Hong Kong Stock Exchange's history. How to interpret China's financial market? I'm joined today by Robert Schiretta, President of International Investor. It's good to see you again, Robert.
Thank you, Don. Good to be here.
Now, help me to interpret China's financial market. What's happening there?
There's no doubt about it that there is another frenzy of investment taking place in the world, and it's taking place in China. But we can't help but draw the comparison to the dot-com frenzy that took place here in the United States at the end of the 1990s. You had so many people telling everyone to get into the market that the only direction was up for them, and many people, of course, suffered.
Mm-hmm. So you are saying that China is like a bubble before it's burst.
Yes.
You know, but at that time it's a dot-com. So what is driving China's stock market these days?
Well, there's an awful lot driving it. And we've talked in the past about how the investment banks themselves are driving it.
Right.
Over $20 billion invested in the banking industry alone in China this year. And I like to point out that sometimes in those individual IPOs, the initial public offerings of some of those stocks, as much as $400 million was garnered in some of the fees for some of those individual IPOs. Total investment banking fees for 2006 were $5 billion. So there's a lot of interest on the professional side to make this happen and make these Chinese companies come public. Why are there so many small investors going in? Because the professionals are telling them it's the place to be. You know, and I know, we see it all the time, both on the internet, on television, everywhere you look, there are professionals telling people to get into the Chinese market now.
Yeah, that did not only happen in this country, but also happened a lot more in China. During the past couple of months, I heard so many of my Chinese friends talk about the China stock market's future. And almost everybody are very feels good about it and very, very optimistic about the future. And they are saying for the next 10 years, China's stock market will perform greatly, and we should buy and hold. And even in the Chinese community, some friends are saying we should form a mutual fund group. Everybody put money in and buy stocks over there.
It's the taxi driver syndrome all over
again. Taxi driver syndrome?
Oh, yeah. Even back in the 20s in the United States, it was well known that, you know, when your doorman and taxi driver started telling you about the stocks they were investing in, that was the time to watch out. Similar phenomenon we see in China. Now, there's no doubt there are not only too many professionals trying to encourage people to get into the market, and small investors are jumping in. How long will it go? You've got some people saying it could go for a decade. We heard the same sort of scenario forecasting in the United States. But if you look back at even in our mature market of the late 1990s, the dot-com era only lasted 5 years, from 1995. By the end of 1999, the peaks were already hit. It was all over. And we see a similar scenario taking place here. Plus, we have some evidence. Again, back to the 90s in the United States, we were told, well, real market forecasting barometers don't matter anymore. Such things as multiples or price-earning ratios and other ratios really were out the window, because in this new world of investing in the dot-coms, those things were irrelevant. Well, we all learned that they were relevant indeed, and the more people didn't pay attention to them, the more they got burned in the end. Same thing in China. Right now, China is trading, the average company is trading at a 17.2 times earnings. In other words, the price of the stock is trading that many times the earnings, and that's future earnings that the company's hoping to bring in. Well, there's a problem with that. It's far above, about 40% above the average for the global emerging markets in the world, which is about 12.5% average. More importantly, it's higher than the average in the United States. Historically, the average price-earning multiple in the United States is between 14 and 17. Mm-hmm. So already China, a brand new market almost, is at the high end of our average. And the problem is the earnings aren't really being supporting those price levels. In China, the average earnings growth of a company is only 10%. In global emerging markets around the world, the average is more like 14.4%, at least in 2006. There are some specific examples I could point to, too, and if you'll permit me, I will. What really bothers us the most is these extreme examples of these new IPOs coming out that the investment banks are pushing so hard. A typical case in point is the Industrial and Commercial Bank. Already, the market cap for it, the total value of what the stock is, according to all the investment capital that's been poured into this IPO, is larger than the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank. Now, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, as anybody knows in the banking industry, has been around for over 200 years. It's probably the most sophisticated, well-entrenched banking organization in the world. It's got few rivals. It has been in China for a long, long time, 150-some years. And for a new upstart bank out of China to suddenly be larger in terms of investment value than Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, you know something's wrong with that picture. And there's one more example I'd like to cite.
Before you jump into that, I would tell you a little bit about ICBC Bank. I read some articles. There's also some whistleblowers in China, too, and they said the Shanghai stock, the composite index, is heavily influenced by a few blue chips, and majorly last year is by the ICBC. Now, the Shanghai composite index doubled last year, and they said, well, If your index can be influenced by a few blue chips, somebody else can easily manipulate the market.
Absolutely.
So don't pay too much attention on this composite because it's very immature and it's only consists of a few companies and it's easily influenced. Is that the case?
Yes, I very much would conform with those views because I do believe you see this. It's true in global emerging markets around the world. When there are too few listings, it is really subject to not just manipulation, but the fact is that five or six companies can suddenly completely change the direction of the market if investors either wax or wane on their future prospects.
Also, what I get is, you know, I believe that in the investment market is also influenced by the people's psychological belief or whether they feel rosy future down the road. And I can tell that many Chinese people, they really kind of very optimistic about the future. And my friends told me that say this is a good time. Why? Because compared to Japan, before their economy took off 20, 30 years ago, and it's a very similar situation there. And at that time, Japan has an Olympic coming into their country, and now China is 2008, it will come to Beijing. And so a lot of small investors feel good about it, and they dare to put money into the Chinese stock market.
Yes, and you can, listen, I would be foolish to discount that. Market psychology plays, it's a major force in any market. It is only at the point where it starts to completely overcome the fundamentals of the market that you know that there's an imbalance that has to be addressed sooner or later. And that's when all of these optimistic investors, and we saw many of them here in the United States in 98 and 99, everyone was encouraged and enthused by the stock market. Everyone felt that our country was growing and moving in the right direction, it seemed. But, you know, a few short years later, many of those same investors felt so damaged by what had happened to them in the markets that to this day, many of them won't go back in. I'm afraid we're going to see a similar experience for many of the Chinese investors. But again, it is very difficult to predict when this optimism and euphoria will stop driving the markets, and the reality of the fundamentals will force them to really retract.
What about excessive liquidity? Because I heard that terminology in China, some economists that they are warning about that because of the excessive liquidity that drives the China stock market that high, and there's a lot of speculation going on. As I said in my opening remarks, the volatility in China's stock market is huge.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. In every measure, that is the case. Partly because China is still an infant market when it comes to the capital markets in general. The stock markets are still very, very small relative to the size of the country, even its GDP. However, the fact is that when you have so much money in foreign exchange reserves, over $1 trillion now, sloshing around, and I say that, I choose that word because right now it's not clear exactly where all that money resides and how it's being used by the government officials to protect, let's just say, the interest of not just investors but even government coffers going forward. My biggest concern is that with all that liquidity, not just some of it fueling the banks, because it does seem to enter the banking system at various points in time, some of it being used to manipulate the currency, of course, it is anybody's guess when policy changes will suddenly move the markets in several dynamic directions. And again, small investors can be at the bottom of that rung when it comes to understanding or being the last to understand when these forces are going to influence the markets.
Well, Chinese government had done a lot in the past, try to cool down the market, try to cool down the real estate market, but it did not, and try to cool down the stock market, did not. They tried to raise the reserve ratio of the bank reserve. Still doesn't work, and so maybe government is not capable of influencing the market anymore. Am I wrong here?
Well, no, and even as we learned in the United States, the Federal Reserve certainly has, in a stable, steady market, Federal Reserve and other government bodies have a certain amount of influence. But when you have a frenzy break out like this, like we had in the stock market in the 90s, like China's experiencing now, it's really out of everyone's control. Mm-hmm. The government can try to manipulate and guide policy a bit, but the kind of money that's pouring into these markets now can overwhelm any government efforts. By that, here's a simple measure of that. The fledgling mutual fund industry is just getting up and running in China. In 2006 alone, it rose 83%, over $110 billion now invested in the mutual fund industry. But that's only a small amount of what's been saved domestically in the banks in China, which is almost $2 trillion by this measure. If more Chinese citizens are influenced and coerced to go into these stock markets and into the mutual fund industry, you can see that there's still an awful lot of money still on the sidelines that could pour into these markets. Again, it'll overwhelm mm-hmm. any government efforts. That's the biggest concern to us. Mm-hmm. And as one more example, I do want to highlight this, is China Life. We spoke about it in the past. China Life, I pointed out, had a lot of problems, things that we felt were rather suspicious activity in terms of its fundamentals and the financing behind it. Nevertheless, my advice was ignored by investors, and the stock doubled on its opening day that the IPO came out, making it the third largest insurance company in the world by market capitalization,
yes.
Larger than Prudential, MetLife, mm-hmm. New York Life. It's too fast and too big a phenomenon, mm-hmm. and it can't last.
Now, before we go, I want you to give me one piece of advice for those people who make a lot of money last year in emerging market, especially in China. You know, just give me one sentence advice. Should they cash in and or should they hold for a year or so like that? Just one sentence.
With your risk capital only, it can be a fast ride, but you have to recognize that you'll be the last to know when to get out.
Wow, hard to understand. Anyway, thank you very much. Coming up next, facing the low price of China's fresh produce, should the U.S. Farm Bill be amended to help produce farmers? Stay tuned. Thank you for watching Digging to China. Existing U.S. farm subsidy policies have been the subject of violent protests outside some World Trade Organization meetings, calling it a way of subsidizing U.S. farmers at the expense of poorer ones around the globe. U.S. fruits and vegetable growers with their much smaller farms have never been part of this debate. in part because their crops yielded higher returns, did not need much support, and were never organized around a single policy goal. But times have changed. In the face of tough new competition, primarily from China, for the first time, U.S. produce farmers joined hands together and formed a lobby group intended to pressure politicians over farm bill debate. I'm joined today by Dr. Sally James, policy analyst with Cato Institute. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Many people around the world called U.S. farm bill an antique way of subsidizing United States farmers at the expense of poorer ones. Do you agree?
I do. I think this is a very outdated policy. It dates back from the Depression, when obviously commodity prices crashed, and a higher proportion of American people lived and worked in rural areas. That is not the case anymore. Farms only account for about 2% of employment. It really is a very outdated and very damaging way to transfer money from consumers and taxpayers to farmers.
Now, there is a new player in town. The fruit and vegetable growers in the U.S. did not enjoy subsidies in the past, but in the face of tough competition primarily from China, they have joined forces for the first time. They won a farm bill debate in 2007. I guess you will be against it.
Well, I am. I think this farm bill is interesting, even though it's the first one I've worked on. People that have worked on many more than I have tell me that we're seeing a lot more players at the table this time and people that have not previously weighed in on this debate, including what we call the specialty crop farmers, and that's fruits, vegetables, nuts, wine. These are players that, as you say, have not traditionally enjoyed subsidies from the government, at least not the direct sort of payments that the commodities enjoy. So we're seeing now that fruits and vegetable farmers, horticultural farmers, are now saying, well, we're facing some tough times, especially from competition from other countries such as China, and we would like some money as well. So far, they seem to be sticking by their line that they don't want the sorts of subsidies that commodities enjoy. They would like money, for example, for marketing overseas. They would like to see more fruits and vegetables in the school lunch program.
Produce farmers are not asking for a direct handout. They are asking for marketing and research assistance. Because of the competition and because of produce industry's fragmentation, it is natural for them to ask government's help, and it is reasonable, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly less trade distorting, so it's less offensive to our trade partners because it doesn't necessarily encourage the types of overproduction that see commodity prices fall worldwide if the United States puts their products onto the market. So it's less damaging in that sense. I don't know that it's really that fair and reasonable. Presumably, what these farmers are arguing is that their products are superior, perhaps in quality or taste, to imported fruits and vegetables. And if that is the case, then consumers will pay for that and they will recognise that when they consume them. I'm not convinced that government money, or I should say taxpayer money through the government, is the best use of taxpayer funds. And these farmers, if they have a superior product and if there are research opportunities available to them, they will find the private money for that.
Chinese farmers are broadly subsidized because China's foreign exchange rate is heavily regulated. It won't be fair for the U.S. farmers to compete with Chinese farmers without any government help, right?
Well, it's certainly true that these farmers are complaining about the fixed currency, and they're not alone. Obviously, there's a lot of groups in the United States who have got concerns about the Chinese currency policy. But I would argue, in fact, that China is really producing according to its comparative advantage here. China has relatively abundant labour and relatively scarce land and capital. And the types of products such as garlic and broccoli and apples that are being produced by the Chinese very competitively are exactly the type of labour-intensive farm goods that China would naturally have a comparative advantage in. So even though there may be concerns about the fixed currency, I'm not convinced that China would not be competitive even if the currency were freely floating.
Talking about garlic, the current import tariff for Chinese garlic is 377%, right?
It is, but the Chinese managed to get around that anyway. And in fact, I guess they're just very, very competitive, because apparently Chinese garlic sells for about half the price of American garlic.
Produce farmers are concentrated in California, Florida, and Arizona. These are very politically important states, critical for 2008 presidential campaign.
They're extremely important states, and for that reason, I think the fruit and vegetable growers may get quite a good hearing from politicians for that reason. Traditionally, as I said, they have stayed away from this debate. There is a bit of a conflict there with the traditional commodity crops, because if we assume that the government does not allocate more money to the farm programs as they traditionally have, then you have a fixed amount of money going to farmers, and an increasing number of farmers if these specialty crop farmers start to ask for money. In other words, what is given to specialty crops is no longer available to the commodity crops. And there might be a little bit of a conflict there. But as you say, these are very politically powerful areas, especially with the 2008 presidential election coming up. So I think they're going to get a much better hearing than what they may have got in the past.
The current administration is in favor of free trade, yet this farm bill remains a roadblock. What is the future for this round? Will the US abandon the farm bill eventually?
I'd like to think so. I think we've got a tough road ahead of us, because, as I said, this farm bill, obviously that's been only around for about 4 or 5 years, but the concept of farm subsidies has been around for 70 years. These are very politically powerful lobby groups, these farm groups, and those of us who are hoping for reform are really up against it. I think the Doha round was seen as a very important way to discipline the subsidies given to farmers, because there are rules about the sort of money and the amount of money that governments can give to their farmers. So it's a little bit disappointing that the Doha round has not gone the way that we would have liked it to. But the administration has signalled it is still committed to the Doha round. Time is running out. And unless we see significant movement from all players involved, including the United States on domestic farm support, then the round is in trouble, and all sides need to contribute to that. Of course, I would also argue that should the round not work out, it's in the United States' interest to reform these subsidy programs. They're a drag on the economy, they're a significant burden to taxpayers and to consumers, and they really don't help with foreign policy overseas when America is seen as hypocritical in world trade talks, pushing for open trade while maintaining these large amounts of support to its farmers.
Last question. Do you think there is such a thing as a level playing field?
Well, I think my concept of a level playing field is probably different from what a lot of these farmers are. What they seem to be saying, or what I'm interpreting their arguments as, is that China is too competitive for us in this area. That is not what I would call an unlevel playing field. What might be considered to be an unlevel playing field is when governments give a lot of subsidies to their farmers, or they protect them behind high import barriers, tariff walls. That is perhaps not fair. But I think the problem here is that farmers are interpreting another country as being too competitive. When they produce in accordance with their comparative advantage, the United States cannot compete with these groups, and they see that as being unfair. I would argue it's just economics, it's comparative advantage, and we would be better off, the United States would be better off producing according to our comparative advantage, and then we would freely trade according to my definition of a level playing field.
Dr. James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please tell us what you think about our show and let us know what you want to discuss about China. Please email us your comments from anywhere in the world. The email address is comments@diggingtochina.org. Thank you for watching. I'm Dong Xiong, and I hope to see you next time. Remember, by working hard, we can and we will eventually dig to China together.